With off the charts rates of gun violence and mass shootings, a regular occurrence in the US, politicians express their predictable outrage and utter prayers for the victims, offering their own diagnoses of the problem. After the Texas school shooting last summer, Republicans blame woke politicians in the schools, saying liberals made it hard for teachers to discipline students. So, Mike, let's start with your favorite line about mass shootings in America.
It's what the Onion publishes each time there's a mass shooting. No way to prevent this, says only nation where this regularly happens.
Yeah, and that's no joke. No exaggeration for sure. Let's begin with Oregon. We passed ballot measure 114 in November that tightens gun laws in the state. What would that law do, and what's its status with the courts?
Well, Oregon is split, as is most of America, on this issue. The gun law passed is an excellent provision that would require background checks before you get to buy a weapon, and it would also limit the size of magazines to 10 rounds, which would effectively get rid of the mass murder weapon of choice, would be these AR-15s and other weapons that can spew out 16 bullets a second, and you can't aim them at all. They would be invaluable if you were in a trench in Germany and being besieged by hundreds of Frenchmen. You could display bullets in every direction, but they're useless for aiming. They're only good for mass killing, and this would limit those as the use of these kind of weapons. The law is st stuck now. Its litigation has ensued both in federal and state court, and the state Supreme Court has unfortunately required that the law remain out of effect until litigation is concluded, which could be many years from now, if ever.
In 2020, the gun control laws in Oregon ranked as the 17th strongest in the country, not an impressive statistic. And the state received a C plus grade from the Giffords Law Center. What do you make of that?
Well, it's Oregon's rural urban split. There are laws passed, like in Columbia County, which would preclude the enforcement of any law restricting the use of guns. That it's the same sort of philosophy that says that sheriffs in these counties have been designated by the Constitution to be all powerful. The Oregon Courts of Appeal have struck down these laws, said they have no force in effect. You can't, on a county level, declare that a whole range of federal and state laws has no effect in your jurisdiction. But Oregon is fairly evenly split, and the laws reflect that.
So let's turn to the national scene. Joe Biden announced last week that he is ordering the Attorney General Merrick Garland to crack down on gun sellers who break the law.
It's interesting he should do that right after having met with Mexico's president, because Mexico has initiated some really striking litigation against gun manufacturers. Two lawsuits, one of civil action in Massachusetts against Smith and Wesson and others, saying that they've caused massive damage by actively facilitating the unlawful trafficking of their guns to drug cartels and other criminals in Mexico. Now, the classic defense of gun manufacturers is like of a Anheuser-Busch. If somebody sells a Budweiser to an underage kid, you can't hold the beer company liable for that. But
It's the degrees of separation that
sure.
protects them.
Right, but Mexico has gone a long way toward showing that these people are shipping their weapons to re places where they know the likely purchasers, like in Arizona, for example, where Mexico has also brought lawsuit, this time against five gun stores who are merchandising primarily to cartels and their representatives, selling weapons. And Mexico is seeking to get around the huge federal immunity to these lawsuits given to gun manufacturers by Bush Jr. in 2005.
Before turning to the history of the protections extended by the government to the gun manufacturers, let's talk a bit more about the Mexico case. Because okay. I understand it, the case draws parallels with dumping poisonous waste across the border into Mexico, and even using the term trafficking, arms trafficking, brings a certain tone of moral hazard that's different from what the gun manufacturers and dealers have faced.
That's right. It's a very good litigation, and they're also using the concept of corporate complicity as developed in the litigation involving climate change, which went nowhere until people found that Exxon and Shell not only knew all about climate change, but were making significant investment decisions based on the reality of climate change. So that then showed that they were keenly aware of and had lied in various official and unofficial places where they represented that it's all a mystery. It's scientists have different views. We don't know.
So does the Mexico case have that kind of, is it more of a general legal argument, or what do they have in the case that could advance it?
Well, they have been dismissed in the Massachusetts case against Smith and Wesson because of federal immunity. But they have one ground of appeal of that case, which they're taking. And their case in Arizona against five stores is proceeding ahead. And they also made a big deal of that whole issue in the meeting with Biden. So they're driving on many fronts.
So let's talk about the history of lawsuits against gun manufacturers and dealers. Why is that an important strategy for gun control advocacy groups? And what have been some of the legal strategies?
Well, civil litigation is always a good way to check bad behavior. It's the fear of being sued that makes many businesses comport with safety laws. And there were several successful lawsuits aimed at gun manufacturers in the 90s for various practices, reckless practices of merchandising their weaponry. But it's so much cheaper to buy a few congressmen than it is to change your fundamental way of doing business. So gun manufacturers successfully lobbied to have a law granting them blanket immunity from lawsuits, finally passed in 2005 by the signed into law by President Bush. This was the same time that a 10-year ban on automatic weapons ended. So as of right after 2005, suddenly you have automatic and semi-automatic weapons available, freely available, and you have a ban against any lawsuits against the people who make those weapons.
There's been a shift in recent decades from personal injury claims to public safety and public health arguments. Can you speak to that shift? I think many successful social movements have framed their grievances and arguments in terms of public safety and public health, shifting from kind of individual moral arguments to public safety.
Well, of course, it's a good way to go. I mean, there are effective gun safety groups generally headed by a recognizable figure like James Brady, who was shot, you know, Ronald Reagan's press secretary, and Gaby Giffords. The Giffords is a great website where they keep tabs of every sort of lobbying and litigation effort going on around the issues of gun safety. But they have moved the issue over to public health. I mean, 43,000 people a year are killed by guns in this country. It's way out of proportion to any other comparable, like European country. I mean, it's 10, 20 times as many people proportionally are shot with guns. Toddlers, toddlers' parents, the school kids, the list of people who are victims is staggering. It should be shocking. And yet it's very, very hard to get any traction in the effort to stop this stuff.
There have been these cases of mass litigation against manufacturers of asbestos, Agent Orange, the Dalcon Shield, silicon breast implants, tobacco, the big pharma. Do you think the weapons face different kinds of obstacles that have at the center a threat to public safety? Are the issues the gun manufacturers and their own political weapons different from these other industries that have faced, in many cases, successful litigation?
Well, it's become a quasi-religious issue with certain factions in this country. There are Congress people who wear automatic weapon buttons rather than American flags in their suits.
Are they the same ones that have a little fetus on the other lapel?
Probably.
They're protecting.
Probably so.
Uh-huh.
There have been successful litigation. The most dramatic one is a $73 million settlement Remington made with the victims of the Sandy Hook mass shooting. And that was because they found an exception. There are some exceptions to the blanket immunity having to do with false advertising. And Remington, it turns out, advertised to young men saying, if you want to be a, quote, real man, buy one of our automatic weapons.
Yeah, that was false. That really didn't give their manhood back. Depends on how you define manhood, right?
Yep.
The conservatives defend these automatic weapons with the slippery slope argument. Is that right? How do you explain their defense of these weapons that no rational person could defend?
Well, the slippery slope argument is notorious in legal circles. It's the one you make when your facts immediately in front of you have no particular value. So you divert the argument away from the case facing you to a non-existent but far worse case, saying that this case, yes, doesn't seem to be so bad, but it is part of a slippery slope. If we do this case, then who knows? Soon enough, we'll be doing this other horrible case. It's a desperate argument resorted to by people who don't have anything compelling in the argument immediately at hand. They try to switch grounds to something that has not yet happened and may never happen.
Conservatives also claim that this is basically Black people killing other Black people, and the problem is the pathology of communities that will get weapons anyway, and that this is a mental health problem, a poverty problem, and not a weapons problem. And yet about 8 in 10 Black adults say gun violence is a very big problem. By far the largest share of any racial or ethnic group, about 6 in 10 Hispanic adults, and only 39% of white adults view gun violence this way. How do you understand the role of racism in gun debates?
Well, it's profound. It's a classic instance of victim blaming and race baiting and race blaming. I mean, I go back to what the Onion said. Yeah, the effort to demonize minority communities should fall flat immediately, because mass shootings are done significantly by white people. They include victims of every race and every age.
Specifically white men, right?
Yes. It's not. This gun violence is far from being confined to ghettos or any specific section of this country. It's endemic everywhere and may burst out in any part of our country at any time. As the Onion said, I'll repeat it, we are the only country, we say that nothing can prevent this. It's in the nature of our communities or in the nature of our mental issues. But every other country in the world has much more severe gun laws and far fewer gun victims.
And that's a classic defense, a corporate defense, right? We're only supplying the demand.
Right. Well, exactly. And so the task of litigation against it is to show that they are creating that demand. They're going to where the demand exists. And the demand for something like a deadly weapon is primarily in the world of, or significantly at least, in the world of drug cartels and criminals.
So, Mike, in closing, if you were representing the left in a court of law, what would be your wise counsel in terms of how to approach this horrific problem of gun violence in America?
Well, I think the Oregon law is very sensible, very reasonable. There's nothing in Oregon's gun laws that would keep people from being able to protect themselves with rifles, which you can actually hit what you aim when you're using them, or handguns. There's nothing in the requirement of background checks, or certainly nothing in the restriction of magazine sizes that would in any way limit your ability to defend your own home.
But this would include having a license, much as we have driver's license. Conservatives aren't arguing we should allow teenagers to drive without driver's licenses, I assume. Well, maybe some of them are.
My wife's father taught her how to drive on Texas roads when she was 13 years old. So there's not a lot of serious deference paid to the department.
Right, but they don't campaign against driver's licenses. But this has weapons have I think also a certain symbolic power as well as material consequences. And I think advancing this idea that this is that of the kind of paranoia that other people are threats and scary. People from the city are scary. So I think there's a social psychology to this that is important as well.
Well, Jan, that is universal. I think even France and the split between the cities and countries is very common. It's not isolated to Oregon in any way or any other or this country. I think the real problem is simply one of guns and limiting people's access to them, limiting the possibility of impulsive shootings, of impulsive suicides, of mass murders. This can be done and is done in places that have the same splits ideologically as the U.S., but they're able to agree to limiting access to these deadly weapons.
I remember when I was doing research years back on the public concern about increased suicide rates among service members and veterans, and finding that the most important predictor of suicide is access to a weapon and comfort in using it. And service members and veterans have access to weapons, have been trained to use them and are comfortable using them. And when they're in a distressed state, are more apt to have means of ending their lives. And I think that was not as apt to be reported in the news releases on higher suicide rates among veterans. So I think I agree, and I think people in the field of suicidology would agree that one way of reducing suicides and family violence is to reduce access to guns.
It's very clear. The Giffords website has shown that there's an easy correlation between gun control and suicides.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow the Oregon case as it languishes in the courts, and also this Mexican case that has this emphasis on trafficking on the U.S. side of the border. Thanks for being with me today.
You're welcome, Jen. It's always a pleasure.